Okay, this is called I Feel a Bit Normal Today. I'm small now. I'm sitting in Miss Gelson Leiter's first grade class. She's upset and saying, if the person who did this bad thing would please raise their hand, I won't punish them. A ton of tension in the room, but no motion. She's looking right at me. Ice rays. This is a chance for someone to learn about honesty. Please just raise your hand. What? This thrift shop quilt of an old lady was asking me to admit to the whole class that I'd slashed their pictures. I was safe. My knife was hidden in a house key that someone had split open and then inserted a small blade between the halves. I'd drawn a black car and a pretty lady in a white dress, and she hadn't picked it to go up on the wall. That had made me really angry, so I'd waited till no one was looking, snapped open the knife, and sliced each picture. Zip! Right down the middle. How dare she not pick my picture? I might have been small, but I knew the significance of this moment, of what she was telling me about who I was and who I was going to be. I knew that I would forever be someone whose picture wouldn't get picked, even though they'd be good ones and just as good as everyone else's. And I knew that I'd have to take revenge for this constantly. I'd be sneaky and sly and patiently watching for opportunities to put things right. And I knew that I'd spend my whole life with all the others whose pictures wouldn't get picked. I wouldn't play with the better-off kids at the north end of our street. No, my friends would be the Slovenian DP kids who lived in a rented house on the other end of our block. Kids whose clothes didn't fit them very well. Later, it'd be all the black kids who nobody liked, not just for traditional reasons, but also because they smelled like discount store soap. And still later, it'd be all the crazy girls with deep hurts, and the bikers and the rock and rollers and the weirdos and the cranks. But especially, I'd be lumped with all the poor ones, the hard luckers, the unwanted and undesired, the ones who for some reason hadn't been picked for anything, ever. We were all destined to be prey for the rich, the pretty, and the favored. This was my first secret, Miss Gelson Leiter, and if I told it, I'd lose it. Well, I'm big now. I'm driving a car outside of Boston, and my thoughts are smashing into each other. Weston and the Massachusetts Turnpike exit only a mile away. Think fast, pal. If a car is traveling 60 miles per hour, it'll take 1 minute to go, but I'm doing 95. So that's, you're stalling. No, I'm not. 205,280 feet divided by, oh, yes, you are. No. Look, are you going to do it or not? Well. Well, I pull over to the side of the road. Things needed sorting out. First off, I don't like sweating inside my only suit. Black's my best color, and whatever I decided to do, I'd want to stay as crisp as creased lightning. Of course, radical states of sharpness are never achieved by clothes alone. The right accessory is essential. In this case, I'm wearing a Jaguar, a limited edition Vandenplas, also Schwarz, like my suit. You don't just get in this car, you put it on. This road yacht's not mine, of course. It's my future father-in-law's. And no, I'm not getting married either. My fiancé had been picked as the maid of honor in her big sister's wedding. So I'd come up early to lend a hand. Actually, it's more accurate to say I'd been drafted. I'd have never volunteered since I was broke again, which is not the best position to be in when hanging with one's future in-laws. Besides, I hated weddings. They resembled a military operation. Despite late summer storms, I spent a frantic week in the matrimonial quartermaster corps, sailing a supply ship station wagon through flooded back streets, trolling for crinolines and damming the torpedoes to get the flower girls to their eyelash-dying appointments on time. I'd racked up heavy active duty, but my efforts paled compared to the bride's. She'd spent a year putting this show together, and even though we were staying under the same roof, our paths had crossed only once. She'd allowed herself the luxury of a 10-minute cave-in and was sitting in the living room numbing her nerves with a G&T. I was roaring out the door again when she'd looked up and mock-threatened, "See what you'll have to go through." Heh, heh, heh. It was only today, the wedding day, only 15 minutes ago, and only after everyone had left for the church, that all this work might actually result in a wedding. My fiancé's father had left the Jaguar for us, handing her the keys after loading two cases of champagne into the trunk. He'd also left his wallet and checkbook in the glove box because all the pockets of his rented tux were sewn shut. "Careful with that wallet," he told us. "There's $2,000 in there. The caterers are insisting on cash." About halfway to the church, my fiancée had turned to me with a look of true horror and groaned, "Oh, my God, we forgot the rice and the crystal goblets." The rice needs no explanation, but the idea behind the goblets was to have champagne in the bride and groom's limo. Aside from being a nice romantic touch, the wine guaranteed that the usually shy groom would be friendly and loose at the reception. 3 minutes of swearing and accusations later, I voiced the obvious. "No problem, baby," I said. "I'll drop you off at the church, then go back for the rice and goblets." "But you'll miss the wedding," she argued back, "and my father is really paranoid about who he lets drive his car." "He'd never know," I said, "and this car can do 145 miles an hour. Believe me, I won't miss the damn wedding." And it was on the way back that the sweetness of my situation became apparent. It began when I thought about the thousands of dollars I'd seen change hands in the past week, which contrasted so viciously with my seemingly terminal poverty. I was chronically money sick, and it was the focus of all my brooding. I thrashed around for years trying to figure out what it was that everyone else seemed to know about money, but I didn't. As the highways blurred by, I once more ran through what I call the five vexations. Why did money invariably gravitate towards the unimaginative and loathsome? How could anyone believe that crap about upward mobility when this was clearly the age of diminishing returns? Why did I have to stop doing what I wanted to do so I could earn money so I could do what I wanted to do? Why did we, as a culture, value hustlers and paper pushers more than craftsmen and laborers, while simultaneously preaching bilge about how work builds character? And why was money, this artificial construct, this agreed-upon mass hallucination, the taboo subject? People were more comfortable publicly discussing the goo that oozed from their privates than talking about money. And then about 100 feet from the exit, everything had converged into an exquisitely dense temptation. The family had a friend house-sitting because thieves had taken up reading the wedding notices in the Boston papers, and while bride was saying, "I do," they do a little B&E. Today's chore had been to polish 3 generations of family silver. It was laid out on the dining room table. All I'd have to say is, "Dave, they told me to bring this stuff to the reception." He'd probably help me load it into the car. Right next to the champagne. There were other tugs and twists. I didn't know Boston too well, so I brought a road atlas. Once I joked that, "Hey, honey, we could get out of this whole thing by taking Route 128 north to I-95 to I-93, and it's a straight shot to Canada." I'd have the length of the wedding, a full Congregationalist service, because first daughter wanted it that way, plus a few hours head start before they'd catch on. Both the Jaguar's gas tanks registered full, so there would be no need to stop. I even resembled my father-in-law, so I might get away with using his driver's license at the border. And forging his signature on one of his checks couldn't be too hard. So I'm sitting by the side of the road now, rocked by the womp of the passing trucks. I get out to pace, and while reaching inside my jacket for a smoke, I find my passport. The last time I'd worn this suit was on a quick foreign courier flight I'd taken to earn a few bucks. Guess I'd forgotten to put it away. I'm standing by a highway in eastern Massachusetts, leaning against the Jaguar, leaning against the full weight of my history, smoking a cigarette, playing with a set of keys.